was, I thought that was phenomenal. The positive emotion bit, I thought was very good. And you were saying that that came from outside the sort of main tradition of the texts. Any ideas? And that's an area that I find phenomenally useful and powerful and important. Because when speaking personally, one can get into, I can get into negative spirals.
Absolutely, yes. Yes.
Spirals of negativity, if you like, and have done in the past, with quite profound consequences. But where does that, do you think that comes from? I suppose it doesn't really matter where it comes from, but where does that sort of...
Well, it's explored in traditional Buddhism in the Abhidharma teachings, which is the categorization of mental states. Mm. So what you get there is many, many positive emotions, as we would call them, listed. Mm. But that phrase is not a Buddhist phrase. Mm. So they would be described as skillful mental events. That's a translation, but it's a more literal translation than positive emotions. And it's useful to look at them, each of them, in turn, and to see whether it's something that you can find the seeds of in your experience. And an obvious one is metta, so metta or loving kindness, and the way that you've got approaches like the Metta Bhavana meditation that help you to find the seeds of loving kindness and then to let it grow stronger. And so a lot of Buddhist practice is working at that level, it seems to me, of positive emotion. And it's so crucial to do that, because you can have a really deep understanding, a really fantastic sense of where you're really trying to head, but you lose your spirits, your energy goes. You've got to care about it, and you've got to care about yourself, you've got to care about other people, it seems. And that's, so I think positive emotions are great. You don't have to use that Western term, you can say skillful mental events if you want to.
It's a translation thing,
yes,
because loving kindness, I suppose, even in traditional Buddhism, that's how usually people would translate metta.
Yeah.
But I suppose Sangharaksha used positive emotion, maybe, yeah, because he thought some Western people can relate better to that kind of,
yeah,
language.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
I'd really love you to do a paper on this. Maybe it says something about me, but really to go into detail as to where some of these ideas came from, you know, whether it was Jungian analysis or Rhys Davids or,
yes,
you know, whatever,
yes,
would be really fascinating.
It is. It's interesting, that one of the love mode and the power mode, trying to trace that back to some of D.H. Lawrence's writings, mm-hmm, where he uses those terms.
But you have an idea where in D.H. Lawrence's writings?
Now, it's in one of his lesser-known novels. I think it might be the one called Phoenix. But if you read Kangaroo, which is one of the ones I have read, the Australian novel, he goes into that sort of area there. In a way, it's interesting because he is, to some extent, celebrating power. So he's using it in a rather different way, celebrating sort of potency, I suppose you could say. If you've read D.H. Lawrence, you can probably imagine the kind of thing he's saying. Another thing I didn't mention is the creative and the reactive mind, which we're going to do some stuff on that in the next series here. And again, the idea, again, that's, in a way, it's very traditional. You know, there are two kinds of mental approach, but that's calling them creative and reactive is, again, a very Western approach. And I haven't quite worked out exactly where that comes from, but you'll find it in Eric Fromm, for example.
I was just going to say that, you know, it's good to re-examine the teachings like that, isn't,
yes,
it? Because,
yes,
like the love mode and the power mode thing, because people within our movement at the moment are thinking about, well, you know, because Sangharaksha put it like that, it sounds like, yes, it should always be the love mode, never the power mode, power is always bad. Well, it isn't, you know, you can look at, there is a positive,
yes,
aspect to,
yes,
power as,
but there's also a negative, and it can be misused. And, you know, in the current reflections on our history, there are occasions where he himself seems to have misused his power,
yes,
or at least his influence,
yeah,
you know, to have his own way, as it were. You know, so it's in a way, it's good to sort of use basic Buddhist teachings, the explicit ones, the clear ones, like those ones on kindly speech, for example, and say, no, there's never an excuse for being unkind in your speech.
I was a bit surprised about the retreats one, because there are Buddhist traditions that use, like the Tibetan tradition, people do retreats.
Yes. Well, to some extent, it's a question of whether it's assimilation or whether it's translation.
Okay.
So they wouldn't use the word retreat.
Yeah.
And the word retreat is a Christian term from the Christian tradition, because Christians do those retreats.
Yeah.
But yes, you're right. I'm not saying it's just purely a Western thing that's been adopted. But I think the reason I wanted to mention it is because it does seem to me it's a real issue for Westerners that you do have the option of being a monastic in most traditional Eastern Buddhist countries. Where if you really want to practice intensively, you can enter a monastery, and for a while at least you can do that. But we don't really... I mean, it is an option over here, but very, very limited ways. So if you don't really have that as an option, how do you practice intensively in a Western country? And I think that to go on a retreat, preferably for at least a week or even longer, it just makes such a huge difference to your life. I really would recommend it.
Well, about the precepts, is that sort of like a mix of traditional Buddhism, you know, the five precepts that we tend to...
No, that's an interesting one, because we're very traditional with that, the five precepts. They are universally accepted in all Buddhist traditions, the five precepts. But if you look at, I didn't do a comparison really with other modern Buddhist teachers, but look at Thich Nhat Hanh's tradition, for example, and he's adapted them. So he's taken the 10 precepts, which is another list which is used in the order, but he's adapted them to what he calls the 14 precepts of interbeing in his community. And they're very much updated and even changed to some extent. So in that sense, we are more traditional than Thich Nhat Hanh's order of interbeing. But in other respects, they're more traditional than we are. But so the five precepts are basic. Now, there are positive versions of the five precepts as well, but the particular wording that we use when we recite it, that's from Sangharakshita.
Right.
So to say, with deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body, is not a direct translation of anything from the Pali.
So he just created that from...
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that the positive equivalent of avoiding harming living beings, which is the first one, which I've just forgotten what it is now, Panatipata. So Panatipata Veramani Sikapadang is I undertake the principle of training to avoid or to abstain from harming any living beings. And it's explicitly stated in the traditional that the opposite of that is to practice with love. Yeah. But what he's done is produced a set of positive precepts to counteract that tendency, particularly in Southern Buddhism, to be a little bit on the negative side and just saying what you don't do and not reminding you what you do as well. It's there in the tradition, but it's not normally recited. And he's written a number of other texts, like puja texts and things that we use.
Mm. Okay. And he connected it with body, speech and mind.
He connected with body, speech and mind,
which
yes.
It is, but not... again, it's made something explicit, which is implicit.
Yeah. Well, although it is in some sources that is explicit as well, the different precepts for body, speech and mind. Yeah.
Thinking a bit about practices and methods, I mean, suppose Sangharakshita had had to, in what he was doing, sort of deal with the fact that we're in the West, but I suppose he's also dealing with the fact that we're now 2,500 years on, and in that time there's been obviously quite a diversifying of Buddhism, you know, from the original Theravadan, I suppose, to the different kinds of Mahayana practice and the way they do things, and you know, Tibetan and that sort of thing. It's sparked by something I heard you say once before, I think, that is there any element that there's been a, I don't mean negative here, you know, there's been a cherry picking, there's been a trying to pick parts of practice or ritual or how you go about doing things from the different traditions, and is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, that's a very good question, isn't it? And this comes under the selection process, doesn't it? In a way, you've got to be, unless you try and adopt wholesale one Eastern Buddhist tradition, which is an option, definitely, then you've got to be selective in the practices that you do. And if you're not restricting yourself to only taking them from just the Theravada or even just the Sri Lankan Theravada or something like that, then in a way you are doing some cherry picking, aren't you? So what's the basis on which you do that picking? And it's a very risky thing to do because it might be done on the basis of personal preference. It might be the things that suit Sangharakshita personally. Maybe they work really well for him. But he's got to try to get beyond that point and say, no, I've got to do something that is going to suit different kinds of people in the West, not just people like me, or not just the things that I think I've got to. And so to some extent, it means you've got to have some experimentation. And there has been careful experimentation, and I hope there will be more in the future, that I hope that the practices that we do have are not set in stone, they're not fixed, and other people will be bringing in practices from their own experience, and their own experience may be based in other traditions, including non-Buddhist traditions, and those will come in as well. You know. So I hope there'll be an evolution in that process and that we can look back. So at the moment, for example, we teach mindfulness of breathing and metta bhavana as the basic practices for beginners, with just sitting and mindful walking as well, but particularly mindfulness of breathing and metta bhavana. They're both from the Theravadin tradition. They're both strongly emphasised in the Theravadin tradition, but they do seem to be a nice balance, I think. I do like that myself, but the way we teach them can change. We've taken the way we teach them particularly from Buddhaghosa, but we don't have to use those ways. You know? So it's a very interesting phase to be in when it's still so new. I know 50 years seems a long time, but it's not really a long time. The 50th anniversary is coming up in just a couple of weeks' time. And the next 50 years will see enormous changes, I'm sure.
I suppose the selection, Sangharakshita, that comes from his teachers, isn't it? So the teachers he had when he was in India, I suppose, maybe.
To some extent, yes.
Remember you saying that he's actually experienced both traditions in his teaching, and therefore he'd tasted from the side. And yet what you're saying there sounds like those key teachings of the Metta Bhavana and mindfulness of breathing actually come from a Theravadin. Which elements come from the...
This could be a big talk. Yes, I mean, I mentioned the four great reliances there as an example of something from Mahayana Buddhism, but I suppose I don't know if you were here for Akasha Devi's talk on the Bodhisattva ideal. So we've got very strongly the Bodhisattva ideal coming from the Mahayana, the sense of the Buddhist life needing to be an altruistic life, not a life where you're just working on your own spiritual needs, but you're engaged with others. And the emblem for the order being the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, so the order trying to be something that's going out to the world like a bodhisattva, and is not just going into retreat, you know. So there's an example of something. And then you'll also find visualization practices from tantric Buddhism as well being used, particularly within the order. But there is a wide range. The puja is from the Mahayana tradition, the sevenfold puja that we do is from the Mahayana.
Devotion, I was thinking a lot of what I said It's later, it's Mahayana and later things that have beefed up, I suppose, more of the ritual and devotion.
Well, there is actually a lot of ritual and devotion. If you go to Sri Lanka, you'll find the temples are full of their own types of ritual and devotion. And our order in India tends to use as its main puja a puja called the Buddha Puja, which is a Theravadin puja. It's true. We think of the Mahayana as being very, very rich and imaginative, and it's true. There is a lot of that in there, more cosmic, you get it in all tradition. Even Zen, which is regarded as incredibly austere, they have loads and loads of chanting and ritual and things like that.
What was the wording of the first reliance?
Rely on the teacher and not the teaching. So it's rely on the Dharma and not the person is the literal translation. So it's rely on the Dharma, don't rely on the pudgala, which is the word for a person.
I've also heard Buddhism talk about not the importance of not selecting teacher whose defects predominate. Would you see that as different, or would you see that as...
No, I think that's important. I do think that if you... First of all, again, it raises a whole issue, doesn't it? What does it mean to have a teacher? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it does seem to me that, again, it's very traditional in Buddhism that you do need teachers. I put it in the plural. It doesn't have to be one. In other words, you need mentors. You need people that you're in personal contact with who you can derive some benefit from because they have less defects, presumably, and more positive qualities than at the moment you have. as well as no doubt more knowledge and more experience and all that kind of thing. So I do think that is an important thing, that when you look for a teacher, that you are open to the possibility of defects. I mean, in Tibetan Buddhism, you have this interesting contrast there, where it's turned round as well, and that you also regard your teacher as being the Buddha. So you have to hold at the same time the sense of the teacher being imperfect and having defects and being open to those, and maybe even saying, there's too many defects here for me to go to this teacher. And on the other hand, seeing the teacher as the Buddha. Now, I think that's probably going a bit too far, for at least for us in the West. I think that causes a lot of problems and does cause problems, I think, for people trying to follow Western Tibetan Buddhism in the West, this injunction to see their teacher as the Buddha. So I think that's probably unwise. And it also tends to mean that they'll try to choose the highest as their teacher. They want their teacher to be the closest as possible to the Buddha, which is great, but it does mean they probably won't have much personal contact with them. And I know a lot of people who follow Tibetan Buddhism who wait for the annual visit of their great Tibetan teacher who comes to their centre, and they will all sit, you know, at the feet of this person, but they won't have very much opportunity for real interaction of having a proper mentor, you know. So I don't want to say there's anything wrong with sitting at the feet of a wonderful, great, occasional teacher, but I think we do need personal teachings as well. And for that, we may have to accept people that have defects. You know, I mean, if you can find people without defects, or at least with fewer defects, then that would be definitely preferable. So do go. I wish you luck.
Is that people who go to the library with a tape measure, then?
What I found helpful is the fact that he's encouraged, allowed people to go to distinct teachers, say in the United States, like Reginald Ray, and get inspiration from him, study with him for a few months, and then bring back his teaching to us. And the same with, say, the feeding of demons practice. To learn that, absorb that, and then bring it back and teach it.
Yes. Well, this is something our very own Carmela Sheila did this by studying under Shenpen Hukum. Mm-hmm. I think Shenpen Hukum he studied under for some time. But I should say in the early days, Sangha actually discouraged that rather than encouraging it. Oh. And he obviously wanted to wait until he felt the movement had its own real identity. And in the early days, he would actually you could go and watch the Dalai Lama giving a talk or something, but he tended to discourage people going on retreats. I think this is what I hear, at least. It never happened to me, but apparently he did, yeah. But I went on a retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh, which I found really very, very interesting and very useful, and partly just to see the contrast and the difference there, yes.
Do you know when that change occurred?
I think it was a gradual process, and it was partly motivated by people getting fed up with it and just saying, well, I don't care what you say, I'm going to go and do that anyway, sort of thing. And people like Carmel Sheila, though, would actually talk it through with Sangharakshita and say, well, I'm thinking of this. And my own teacher, as it were, Vasantra, the person who originally taught me meditation, who I still regard as a very important mentor, he spent a lot of time, we went on a 3-year retreat run by a German who follows a Tibetan tradition, and he wants to bring that intensive 3-year retreat possibility into the movement. So this has come some of the sort of rather careful experimentation going on. Mm-hmm. So there is some, yeah.
So does that mean the idea that you can't shop around has gone? Because that was very, very sort of pushed at one time, wasn't it?
Well, I think that can'ts in general have gone, probably. I mean, I still think, you know, if somebody asked me, said, look, here's a program of the retreats I feel like going on this year, and each one was with a different teacher, well, unless they were deliberately doing a little tour to find out where they felt they belonged, I might say, well, haven't you come to the stage now where you can devote yourself for a while at least to one tradition? So I suppose you could see it as, and this is just my personal view, as a sort of a bottleneck process, in a way, if you see what I mean. That initially, when you first come across Buddhism, you need to be completely open to as much as you can be open to until you find something that you really find works for you. Now, in my case, I came across Vasantra. It worked for me straight away. I didn't bother. I read some Chogyam Trungpa, but apart from that, I didn't really bother with other movements. And so for a while, there's a training process that goes on. Now, when you feel confident in your own jnana, as it were, in your own feeling for the Dharma, it seems to me then you're in a position to go, and I think it's important to do this, actually. It's not just, it shouldn't be discouraged, it should be encouraged. Then you're in a position to really explore the whole gamut of Buddhism in whatever way works for you.
Cultish tendencies, wasn't it, to sort of bring things very much in?
I think it can result in cultish tendencies. Yeah, that's right, yes. But I'm saying there is something positive about that bringing in, you know, about you actually finding your feet in the Dharma in a way. And then once you've found your feet, then you do your exploration. But no can'ts, definitely.
But I was going to say that you do come across some people who would still encourage you not to do that. But mm-hmm. I don't think that's something that's, you know.
Don't do that here. No. Because I was still under the impression that it was a little bit frowned upon too.
Other centres will frown on it more, I think.
Well, so I would frown on it in an individual case, as I say. Like, so if somebody comes to me with their intended retreat programme and says, I'm going on this one, the Thich Nhat Hanh retreat, I'm going down to Sharpham House for this one, I'm going up to this one, I'd say, well, why are you doing that? Why, you know, is that really going to help you? And if they said, well, yes, it's because I want to explore all these different traditions and find which one works for me, I'd say, well, fine. But if it's that they think that they maybe are in a position to sort of do this cherry-picking process, well, are they really? I don't know. And they might be better to concentrate on one movement, you know.
And, you know, there's a difference, isn't there, between this kind of shopping around from not very much to, like, somebody like Visantra, for example, really from his own meditation experience, then sort of veering very much to the Tibetan tradition and finding this Tibetan teacher, or Prakasha has done a similar thing. You know, that... There is a difference between shopping around and following your experience, actually, and then deepening maybe one particular direction of practice.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I think it's not wise to be doing too much frowning or saying can't or anything like that. You know, people are free. You know, if people want to talk something over and have some advice, I might have a view about it, but it would only be a view or a suggestion. It wouldn't be, you mustn't, or something like that, or you're naughty, or anything.